President Barack Obama just wrapped up his final State of the Union address, and U.S. Representative Rodney Davis has some thoughts about what was in it. The Illinois Republican joins us next on another edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair to say.
As I say, hands to kiss and babies to shake. But
I think my record speaks for itself.
That's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is...
colleague Joe Manis.
And we are pleased to have, from the beautiful and wonderful state of Illinois, our very special guest today.
Rodney Davis.
Yeah, the congressman.
Congressman from the 13th District of Illinois.
Now, before we start hitting you with hard-hitting questions, which is a redundant thing to say, tell us a little bit about what the 13th District is, what it borders, what it's comprised of.
Well, my district stretches from right across the river in the Metro East St. Louis area, Collinsville, Edwardsville, up to Calhoun County, Hardin, Grafton, areas that were just ravaged by floods. Go up to Springfield, my hometown of Taylorville. It's right in the middle of my district. Take in a northeasterly direction, Decatur, Champaign, Urbana, and even Bloomington Normal.
It's just a wackily drawn district, basically.
Now, how many square miles are in the district?
I don't have the answer to that, but I have 14 counties,
okay. And
all are parts of 14 counties, which is small when you look at congressional districts in the state of Illinois. My colleague John Shimkus has 33 counties. He stretches north of me.
Oh, yes. In fact, his is like one of the longest districts in the United States, he was telling me.
But you could probably still travel it by car as opposed to Congressman Shimkus, who probably needs like a helicopter to get across it.
I wouldn't let him fly me in a helicopter. Mine's pretty easy to traverse. I live right in the middle, so I'm about an hour and a half from each end of my district from my house. So it's about 3 hours end to end.
So, and how long have you been in Congress?
I just started my second term last year, so I'm starting my fourth year now.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into politics and the contest that got you here, which Jason and I do know something about.
Yeah, this was this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation. This was a new district. It was a district that was represented by a current member of Congress, and he chose to withdraw from the ballot in March of that year or April of that year.
Was that after he won the primary?
After he won the primary.
Which is, I guess, happens more in Illinois than you think, but still kind of unusual.
And we're referring to?
Who?
Former Congressman Tim Johnson.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Tim would have been new to the Metro East area and new to the St. Louis area because his district was usually on the eastern side of the state. He served 14 years. He did a great job. He's a friend of mine. But at that time, he didn't support me for getting this job. Before that, I spent 16 years working on the staff of Congressman John Shimkus.
Okay.
And always had an interest in government. I grew up in a small restaurant family. My dad started working at the first McDonald's ever built in Des Moines, Iowa.
Really?
And worked his way up, had his American dream that he didn't want to leave that restaurant and wanted to own one day. And he started there in 1959. And in 1977, when I was 7 years old, he got his wish. He was awarded a franchise in Taylorville, Illinois, where I still live today. I grew up working there at a very young age and got an interest in government because of my mom and dad talking about how decisions in Washington and in Springfield actually affected the way they ran their business in Taylorville.
Now, you kind of alluded to that when Congressman Johnson effectively vacated the seat. It was a very competitive district after redistricting. It was one of the closest in the nation. It kind of is evidenced by the fact that your opponent in 2012, I think his name was Dan Gill. David Gill, I apologize. He was kind of seen as a fringy candidate beforehand, but was obviously supported very heavily by Democratic groups and made it very, very close, which was probably not necessarily a statement upon you. It was more of a statement that the district became a lot more Democratic after redistricting.
It really did. To draw a marginal district in central Illinois, the Democrats in Springfield, who controlled the gerrymandering of this congressional map, they did a good job of creating a 50-50 district. They put four public universities in, including the University of Illinois, Illinois State University, where my daughter is a proud freshman, Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville, and University of Illinois at Springfield. They have four private universities, eight community college districts. So it was a district meant during an Obama year for a Democrat to win. And we beat the trend, even though we only had 5.5 months to campaign and raise and spend over $3 million.
And then in 2014, the Democrats tried to target you early by recruiting Judge Ann Callas to yes. the race, but that totally fell flat.
Correct.
The race didn't end up being competitive at all. And actually, the competitive race ended up being the Bost Enyart race in the 12th district, which hadn't been Republican in 40 or 50 years. Obviously, Congressman Bost won that race. That's probably a discussion for when he comes on the podcast. But, you know, it's a competitive district. That's the point I'm bringing
so
up.
So as you look this year, sort of, and your primary isn't that far away.
Yeah, primary's March 15th in Illinois.
Right. So sort of how do you see things right now?
You know, I'm one who got engaged in a district like this after working in a very Republican district. And I understand that sometimes competition is good. I like the fact that I have a 50-50 district. I like the fact that it's not a guaranteed win. And it gives me a chance to go out to Washington and really govern because my district is going to be supportive in certain areas and not supportive in others, depending on every single issue we vote upon. Our competitive district this year, instead of being in the top five districts that the Democrats have targeted, maybe now we're in the top 35, which is a different area to be in. We're very proud of the team we put together and the team that helped us craft our legislative success and our campaign agenda over the last 2 years. It took us from a 1,002 vote victory to 36,000 plus the last time.
We'll have to see what happens, but according to a lot of the prognosticators, neither the 12th nor the 13th district are very high on many takeover lists from the Democrats. It's the 12th is kind of astonishing, the fact that it's fallen off the map.
Mike's done a great job.
Yeah, and you know, he was a very strong opponent to Enyart, obviously, since he beat him. And I've heard he's a very hard worker when it comes to campaigning. There'll be a bigger turnout, though, of Democratic voters, so we'll have to see what happens there. But we did want to turn to what is actually happening in government as opposed to the crazy world of politics.
Well, I do hope the prognosticators are right in both cases.
Well, and I know that Congress is off this week, pretty much. So
I'm on vacation with you.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you.
Okay, so what are your thoughts about the State of the Union address last week and sort of what you see as the key issues for the Republican-controlled House this session?
Well, the president came to the floor and was in full lecture mode. There were a lot of issues that he addressed that I thought he could have taken a much more bipartisan tone on, but he chose not to. And I think that was designed to try and give the Democrats who are running to replace him some issues that they could better run on. There were some areas that I thought we could agree. As a matter of fact, one of my guests at the State of the Union, my guest at the State of the Union was Kimberly Wade, John Wade, and Jackie Wade, mm-hmm. Whose twin brother Johnny passed away on Christmas Eve from brain cancer. The president mentioned a moonshot to try and eradicate cancer. That was something I was so excited to have him stand up and say that he was going to put Vice President Biden in charge of that mission. I'm somebody who's married to a 17-year cancer survivor. The same year my wife was diagnosed with colon cancer at age 26, my mom was diagnosed with lung cancer and passed away. Mm. I can't imagine what the Wades went through with the child with cancer, but what I can tell you from my experience and from what I hear from them and others, this is our shot. This is our shot to save many families from the heartaches that the Wades have experienced and also the issues that my family and many, many families throughout this great country experience every day.
I know that increased funding for NIH actually has been something of a bipartisan
issue. Yeah, we increased NIH funding, I think it's $264 million this year. We made sure that's going toward research and not toward building buildings. That's what we need.
Now, is there anything particular in the State of the Union address that you were like, oh, you just did not go along with?
His continued war on coal under the guise of climate change. You know, this is a president who is single-handedly trying to destroy the coal industry in this country. And I don't know why, because we have baseload generating capacity in a very cost-effective way coming from coal. And I have four coal-fired power plants in my district, some of the best-paying jobs in my district that are organized labor. And they're at risk of losing those jobs if we don't have the ability to burn coal in this country. And I think the president's going to double down on that war on coal. I think he doubled down on that message in the State of the Union. And I'm going to do everything I can to fight him on it.
Now that Congress is controlled by Republicans in both chambers, is there really anything that the president can do on that issue that would be effective anymore? And when I talk about that issue, I mean trying to counteract or get rid of coal through policy or whatnot.
Well, he issued another executive action. The president is going to use executive action over the next 11 months, I think, on a regular basis to put forth his own political agenda. He wants to close Guantanamo. The president spent more time talking about closing Guantanamo Bay than he did about a strategy to eradicate ISIS from operating as they are now as a pseudo-nation state. This is a president who I think has his priorities mixed up. He wants to fulfill his campaign promises that he made 7 years ago at the expense, I believe, of families who are paying lower rates right now just to turn their lights on.
What are you hearing from your constituents on this issue? I mean, the whole thing with terrorism and Guantanamo Bay and all that.
Because, well, and I kind of intermingled coal into that, too,
sure.
I know. And I live in coal country in central Illinois. A lot of my constituents are concerned about this war on coal. But almost every constituent and every poll that I've seen lately, terrorism and national security is number one issue. People just don't trust this president to put forth a strategy that's going to work. He's failed miserably in trying to earn his Nobel Peace Prize that he got before he was even sworn in. And I think ISIS's growth in Syria and northern Iraq is a clear indication where the president doesn't want to act, doesn't want to build a coalition to stop the most heinous organization I've ever seen in my lifetime from now controlling wide swaths of land in the Middle East.
So do you support ground troops, or how would you deal with ISIS?
Well, I would deal with ISIS, number one, by having America lead. America needs to lead an Arab-based coalition of our allies, those who are facing the risk of having ISIS try to expand into their borders. We ought to be able to put that coalition together, use our military superiority via air. Would like to see Arab ground troops. They need to have skin in the game. And we need to eradicate the Middle East of ISIS controlling wide swaths of land. Remember, they are operating as a pseudo-nation state right now. The president failed miserably when he could have worked with our allies to eradicate ISIS as they were marching across the desert in northern Iraq, and he didn't act. And now we see the results of that in action.
Now, how would he get a coalition together, especially since there's such hostilities between the Sunnis and the Shias as far as the factions of Islam?
Well, there's hostilities between the Sunnis and the Shia, but at some point, even the Sunnis and the Shia, who are more moderate allies, need to come together and realize that ISIS operating as a pseudo-nation state is not in either of their best interests.
I want to talk about an issue that's closer to home, the flooding that occurred both in Missouri and Illinois. First of all, before I ask any policy about FEMA's response or lack of response in your way, how much did the flooding affect your district and the Metro East in general?
Tremendously, not just the Metro East. My hometown of Taylorville, we saw higher water than I've ever experienced in my lifetime since I moved there at age 7. We had 4 people die in the floodwaters in my home county, 2 18-year-old teenagers who decided to go out and unfortunately didn't make it back after they tried to traverse a flooded roadway. We had homes that were recently taken out of the floodplain, according to FEMA's flood maps.
Because of the 93 floods.
Well, they were taken out. No, they were in the flood zone under a previous map.
Okay,
the new map
okay.
was updated. They were told, oh, you're not in the flood zone anymore.
So they didn't have flood insurance.
They had no flood insurance. And they were told they don't need to worry about it. And I was walking through their house as they were taking up drywall that had been flooded on the second floor. I mean, these are issues that we didn't think we would face in Christian County. You go down to Grafton, an area that's used to flooding. They also had flooding that was historic there. We need to be able to utilize our resources to help communities recover. And that's where FEMA needs to make some changes on their policy.
Tell me a little bit about what changes you want them to make.
Well, currently states like Illinois, where we're a very large population, Most of our population, though, lives in the northeast corner where you grew up.
I did. Yeah. The beautiful 10th Congressional District of Illinois. But well, continue.
It's, you know, majority of our population lives there, but most of the natural disasters that take place in Illinois happen in the other 99% of the land masses, including central and southwestern Illinois. So when we're being judged as a state on how we can access that pot of money for public assistance to help communities recover, Illinois sometimes gets shut out because we can't meet a level of disaster damages that other states don't have to meet.
Is that surprising, given that the president is from Illinois and probably realizes this is an issue?
Yes, it is. The president should have realized this was an issue when he was a state senator and a U.S. senator. But remember, it came from that populous area, too, where most disasters don't occur. I've got a bill that I introduced, and I also put language into FEMA's reauthorization that would force FEMA to take into consideration more localized impacts so that it's fair. I mean, think about this. You have a tornado goes through southeastern Missouri, goes through southern Illinois, and goes into southwestern Indiana and northwestern Kentucky. In cases, many cases, that same tornado, every state but Illinois was eligible for public assistance through FEMA. Illinois would not be. To me, that's unfair. Our rural areas should not be punished because of the size and the geographical proximity of our state.
Now, I wanted to talk about something that's been in the topic of conversation, in at least Missouri. I'm not sure in Illinois. But one of the things that has come up is there are some scientists who believe that placing levees in the river and developing a lot within floodplains has exacerbated some flooding, at least in the Missouri area. I'm not really sure if this is as big of an issue in Illinois because it's still fairly rural, and I'm not sure how many levees are done. But I know that this is an issue that has been dealing with Congress people and federal people have been dealing with for a long time. I'm just curious what you think of that discussion and whether you agree that maybe too many levees are being put up to change the flow of the river or anything.
Well, the levees aren't going to go away. So what we have to do is take advantage of the programs that are out there to help remove structures from the floodplain. And I believe Illinois has done a great job in utilizing the hazard mitigation program post-93, post-95. We moved entire towns up onto the bluffs.
Now, your district, though, is mainly affected by what, the Mississippi?
Mississippi and Illinois.
Right, right. So my point
being,
the Illinois
River Basin. Yeah.
My point being, so there were communities that were moved after 93. And so it's a little more different than along the Missouri River, which is in the Merrimack in Missouri, where a lot of this other flooding is going on.
True. But the FEMA hazard mitigation program, you know, doesn't limit itself to one watershed like
right,
the Mississippi.
Correct.
It's in any watershed. Illinois has taken advantage of moving these structures out of the watershed, and we have then less damages, less structural damages on the Illinois side than I believe you do on the Missouri side. As a matter of fact, I took a tour when I worked for Congressman Shimkus of flooding in 2001 or 2002. It was on the helicopter ride with the Corps of Engineers. And you looked left, there weren't that many structures underwater in Illinois. You looked right, whole communities were underwater in Missouri.
Yeah. Was it just because there's been way too much development in floodplains where there shouldn't be, essentially?
I don't necessarily want to, you know, I'm not from Missouri. I don't want to start a civil war between Illinois and Missouri.
Well, you can if
issues.
You want to, but...
been there, done that.
I would tell my good friends, Jason Smith and Blaine Luchtemeyer and Lacey and Ann, we'd win. But, you know, Missouri needs to take into consideration some of the successes states like Illinois have had. You know, maybe the terrain is not going to allow for it, but it's something that I think we've been successful at on the Illinois side to reduce our flood-prone damages to structures by moving those structures and utilizing the programs to buy those structures out.
I mean, the Mississippi River, it's been difficult to try to corral for well over 100 years. I mean, Robert
probably
E. Lee, before he led the Confederate forces,
probably
you know, was head of the group that actually rooted part of the Mississippi. So I know the Mississippi is an odd, I mean, it's this huge river, but it's also odd from the standpoint that it's harder to corral its banks in some ways.
Yeah, but have just to kind of tail off on the flood issue, has Illinois gotten a flood declaration, an emergency declaration yet? Do you think it will at this point?
I don't know. Local officials are doing everything they can to assess the damages. We've encouraged local levels of government local units of government to keep track of every single expense. The state, Governor Rauner, has issued state disaster declarations, emergency declarations. But since the floods have receded, now we know what the damages are going to be, and I think we'll decide. I think they'll decide whether or not to request one soon.
Now, on another local issue that's a topic to Metro East Bay congressmen, it's the question on the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. I think I got that acronym right. I always fail at saying exactly what it is. I know that there's this tug of war right now between building the new headquarters in North St. Louis versus near Scott Air Force Base. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that you are a big proponent of the North St. Louis site right now. I'm being sarcastic, by the way.
I'm going to tell you in very Buffalo Grove, Illinois sense, you're wrong.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Jason was being sarcastic.
I was being sarcastic.
I know that. I know that.
But just tell me a little bit about why you think it should be in the Metro East.
Well, we're talking about an intelligence. We're talking about a military complex. To me, it should be located near one of the most secure military bases we have on the globe. Scott Air Force Base is a success. Many individuals work at Scott Air Force Base that travel from the St. Louis metro area on a regular basis. I know it may be hard for some folks who live on the Missouri side of the river to understand that road works both ways in a commute. You can come across the Mississippi to Illinois and take the metro rail eastward in the morning and westward in the afternoon. It is going to be, it's a better location. It's going to be cost effective for the federal government to put it there. And we need to make sure that that we do everything we can to not look at just the state lines, because there's so many good positive aspects to the transportation system in the St. Louis metro area that I think those who live in St. Louis would benefit from if it was moved to Illinois.
Would it also bolster the future for Scott Air Force Base, which occasionally has come under, efforts to either curb it or reduce it? There have been others who've said it's ridiculous to try to reduce some size of some of the major Air Force bases in the Midwest because that it can't be just coast. I'm just interested in your take on that.
Yeah, because of the leadership of folks like John Shimkus and former Congressman Jerry Costello and many others, Scott Air Force Base has had missions added to it since the last round of BRAC. I think Scott's in a very good position to remain a vibrant part of our military complex. And I think adding to it could only help. But it's not just helping Scott to be more BRAC-proof. It's actually helping the federal government to invest more wisely your tax dollars. And I think being in a secure location like Scott and in the perimeter, around a fence, or just outside the perimeter and creating another perimeter fence, I think is a more cost-effective way to spend tax dollars to keep that type of information that needs to be secure even more secure.
Now, viewing it just from a quick political lens, on the one hand, you have all the Missouri officials who want it to be in Missouri. I think there's a united front there. On the other hand, it seems like the Republicans and Democrats that represent the area and statewide are very much united to getting it to the Metro East, including U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, the governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, I would guess Mike Bost, I would guess you as well. I guess the question is going to be whether the Obama administration, and Obama is obviously from Illinois, wants to help his home state out, or he wants to, do what has been done elsewhere and try to build government buildings in more urban, densely populated areas, which has been kind of a strategy of his. Do you have any insight on how the administration is going to decide on this, or is it just kind of a complete mystery right now?
It's a mystery. I wish I had insight. The president hasn't shown an indication to reward his home state with many projects at the expense of others. Illinois, I think, is a better site for the reasons I mentioned before. This isn't a decision that I think is going to be based upon personal preference or politics. I think it's going to be based upon where the best investment of federal tax dollars is going to be.
Now, have you gotten any signal on the timing of when this decision may be made?
I don't have it. I don't have any indication with me. If there has been, I can get back to you after I ask a couple questions.
In the last 2 minutes that we have, we're going to go through a really quick lightning round. Who do you think will win Illinois in the Republican side for the presidential primary at this point?
And who are you supporting? Are you supporting anybody?
I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say Rubio's going to win Illinois, just because I think there's some indicators in Iowa and New Hampshire that show Trump falling a bit.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if Trump wins one of those states, it'll be him.
Have you endorsed anybody yet?
Or I have not.
Who do you plan to?
I did, but we're coming up very close, and I still haven't made up my mind.
Now, Illinois and Missouri both have presidential primaries on March 15th.
Yeah, we have our whole state's primary.
Correct. So you will have a really crowded ballot. Mm-hmm. But my question is, do you plan on making any sort of endorsement by March 15th once you see a trend coming as we get through Iowa, New Hampshire? Or do you plan to stay on the not endorse until there's a clear nominee?
Yeah, I had always said I plan to endorse. And this is the first presidential race I've been through as an incumbent. I'm still, I think, planning to do that, but I just don't know who right now. I really don't.
My last question for you, does Mark Kirk survive re-election?
Absolutely he does.
Tell me why.
I think Mark Kirk has done a great job as a U.S. Senator. We don't agree on every issue, many issues for that matter. Mark has shown such a determination to recover from the health issues that he's faced. I knew him before. I saw him post stroke 6 months, and I've seen such a marked improvement in his physical capabilities. He's the right person who can pick up suburban votes, and he's been able to do what's necessary to show the Illinois, those in my district in central and southwestern Illinois, that I think he's done a great job and deserves re-election.
How much campaigning will you be doing to help Kirk, and do you think that, let's say, Shimkus and some of the other Republican members of the House in Illinois will be helping him as well?
Well, he's an incumbent senator. We work with him and his staff on a regular basis. We'll do everything we can to ensure that we keep that seat in Republican hands.
Well, all I will say is, as a former constituent of Kirk when he was a congressman, many people have counted him out before, but he won re-election to a fairly Democratic House seat. I think it's going to be a tough race for him, given it's a presidential year. But on the other hand, I wouldn't underestimate him under any circumstances.
Now, do you have any thoughts on who the Democratic nominee will likely be?
Who he will end up facing?
Trump. Yes.
I think Hillary is probably the favorite right now. But again, there is a primary for the Democratic side.
Yes, I think Hillary's going to win. I think Tammy Duckworth will win primary, although I don't think it'll be as easy as one. As many hope.
Yeah, that's what I was
curious
about.
I think Andrew Zopp is going to be a very formidable candidate.
And just ask Peter Roskam how it was to face off against Tammy Duckworth. I think people thought that she was going to beat him, and he beat her pretty handily back in 2006.
In a very rough year for Republicans. Peter has that experience. Tammy and I served together. Tammy and I worked together on a wide variety of issues. But I want to see that seat kept in Republican hands. It's crucial to the Republicans maintaining control of the Senate.
Now, Illinois, although you right now have a Republican governor, is generally being considered Democratic-leaning, especially when it comes to presidential politics. Do you think that it will be the Democratic nominee for president who carries the state, or do you think your Republican nominee, whoever it is, will do so?
Boy, I sure hope it's the Republican nominee, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure it's the Republican nominee. But I think just as Missouri is solidly in the red state corner right now by prognosticators, Illinois is solidly in the blue state. And if those change, it's going to be a very interesting year.
It's not 1988 anymore, unfortunately, but we are out of time. We want to let you get back to Taylorville. Thank you so much for joining us today for all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. It's JMANNIES.
And how would we follow you on Twitter?
Twitter is just
Thank you very much. Until next time.